Council, I'll let you know that you will be observed today by a group from the Maple Grove Senior High School. And we're very excited to have you here and hope this is a very rewarding experience for you. Council, you each have, I will call the case, and the case is Reed versus Sioux Line Railroad Company. Council, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments, and the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments, and you may proceed at this time.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Timothy Masterson. I represent the appellant, Gabilon Grain, LLC. The issues on appeal here today are whether the district court erred when it ruled that Gabilon Grain's contacts with the state of Minnesota were sufficient to confer general personal jurisdiction over Gabilon Grain. In finding jurisdiction, the district court ignored U.S. Supreme Court precedent from Daimler AG versus Bowen and BNSF Railway Company versus Tyrell. The standard of review in this case is de novo. The relevant facts in this case are that the plaintiff respondent David Reed was injured on July 19th of 2017 while working for his employer, the defendant, a respondent Sioux Line. The injury occurred on tracks near a facility owned by Gabilon Grain, which is located in Carrington, North Dakota. Mr. Reed sued the Sioux Line Railroad under the FVLA in Hennepin County. Thereafter, Sioux Line brought a lawsuit, a third-party complaint against Gabilon Grain pursuant to an industry track agreement that had been entered into with a prior owner of the facility in Carrington, which was the PV Company. That lawsuit was commenced by service of a summons and complaint addressed to Gabilon Grain's registered agent in Bismarck, North Dakota. Gabilon Grain brought its motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction in response to that third-party complaint. In opposing the motion to dismiss, respondents sought to, well, first of all, respondents, Sioux Line in this case, would have the burden of proving sufficient contacts to confer jurisdiction over Gabilon Grain. Those specific jurisdiction, which would be jurisdiction based on acts within the state of Minnesota, do not exist in this case. The plaintiff was a North Dakota resident. He was injured in North Dakota. Gabilon Grain is a Delaware corporation with its principal place in Nebraska, principal place of business in Nebraska. Excuse me. As a matter of general jurisdiction, Gabilon Grain employs 43 employees in the state of Minnesota, and it has two facilities that it operates, as well as has a pass-through agreement with a storage facility. It is also has a registered agent located in Moorhead, Minnesota. Gabilon Grain's motion was heard by the district court on September 5th of 2018. The order thereafter was issued, which decided that there were sufficient contacts with the state of Minnesota, and by finding that, the court ignored the precedent of Daimler and Tyrell. And the facts of both of those cases are important here because
before we get into those, I mean, it doesn't seem to be that any party is justifying this district court's decision for the reasoning that the district court
correct
gave, right? So what we're talking about is having a registered agent in Minnesota and whether there's consent. Is that right? I mean,
well, that's what the new issue
that's
is.
What the new issue is there's a new theory to justify jurisdiction, and it's a consent-based theory. And Gavilan, I think, makes a number of arguments why we should not address this new theory for the first time on appeal, why it fails as a matter of law, et cetera, and because I think that Gavilan could produce facts that would refute it and didn't have the opportunity. I want to focus, if I may, just go to that last question. What is it, what record is Gavilan unable to make that might, if for example, we thought, if assuming for purposes of argument that we thought a consent-based or theory held water, notwithstanding Supreme Court decisions since then, et cetera.
Sure.
What were you unable to produce that would be relevant?
I think there's two significant prongs to that. One is the consent-based. As Rykoff Sexton held that consent is a valid exercise of jurisdiction. There is no decision in Minnesota finding that the provisions for limited liability companies in Minnesota, by having a registered agent, thereby consent to general jurisdiction in the state of Minnesota. The other is what facts, and Soo Line relies on Rykoff Sexton, which involves corporations, not LLCs, but Rykoff Sexton, its preceding cases, the U.S. Federal court cases, all of those cases are based upon service of a registered agent in the state where the courts are claiming general jurisdiction. This is not that case.
Well, is there any issue under Daimler that just the fact of having a registered agent isn't sufficient to impose
general That is jurisdiction? Not an issue that was addressed by Daimler. That is correct. And there's references, I want to say in Tyrell it was an issue that may have been addressed, but I don't think it was addressed by the Supreme Court. It may have been in one of the earlier decisions. The
actual question is actual service, which is generally sort of a different question of whether there's arguably personal service. For example, I'm a resident of Minnesota. It's not a general jurisdiction issue, but if I don't get served, that's a different defense, right?
Correct. And so getting back to this service, if there is an agent that lives in Minnesota that can give consent to general jurisdiction, that agent didn't do it in this case. And we have the address on the summons as being Bismarck. What we don't have in the record currently is the affidavit of service, which confirms the location of service.
Is there any other fact that you think Gavilan was unable to develop at the district court?
I do believe that there are facts associated with the consent itself and the process for applying for a registered agent. For example, under the corporate statutes, there are specific information that has to be filled out on a state form regarding the consent. And we know from the case law that the consent that has, the statute for the corporations actually says irrevocable consent. So whoever's filling out that form is put on notice that they are consenting to service a process.
Right, that's in a statute. So that's a statutory issue, the difference between the LLC statute, right, and the corporation statute. But I'm just trying to think, like, what record evidence, like what factual evidence would you envision needing to put in if that –
well,
because that's a legal argument more than a factual one,
well,
right?
Well, I think it does play into the representative of the LLC – who was filling out the form.
So the actual form.
Correct. Correct. And what information was conveyed in filling out that form. Again, with a corporation, that form has to be signed by a president or other officer or who has the ability to bind the corporation to the consent that the statute requires. The LLC statutes do not use the word consent. What they say is that you have to have a registered agent who is available to accept service or notice or anything else allowed or required by the law. And that's where we come back now to Daimler and Tyrell. What is allowed under the U.S. Supreme Court precedent as far as exercising jurisdiction over a corporation?
And I'm just going to ask one more question before you get into the legal stuff. So related to the record evidence, is there any, I think that we're asked by opposing counsel to take judicial notice of forms that are filed, et cetera, with the Secretary of State. Is there anything that you, I mean, so you have like the absence of evidence related to actual service, that I don't think that there's anything in here that we're asked to take judicial notice of related to that. But with respect to information conveyed in, et cetera, and applying for registration here, is there anything, what's your response to the idea that we can just take judicial notice of what's at the Secretary of State's office? Does that get to that second question?
Yeah, I think that there are circumstances where that is appropriate. I mean, you can go on the Secretary of State's website and you can see whether a company is registered in Minnesota. You can see where their office for their registered agent is located. But none of that is available online addresses the issues we're dealing with here today. So there is certain information that would be appropriate to take judicial notice of, but it does not answer the factual issues that we're trying to address here.
Like what was on the application and whether the agent was served.
Correct, and what Gavilan Grain understood they were doing when they appointed a registered agent. And, you know, there are significant differences between corporations and LLCs. For example, for an LLC under MnStat 322C.0801, the law of the state or jurisdiction under which a foreign limited liability company is formed governs the internal affairs of that company, and it also governs the liability of its members, managers, and governors. Furthermore, a foreign limited liability company may not be denied a certificate of authority by reason of any difference between the law of the jurisdiction under which the company is formed and the laws of this state, the state of Minnesota. So foreign LLCs can register to do business, but they continue to be governed by the laws under which they're enacted. Under MnStat 303.09, the powers of a foreign corporation are the same as a domestic corporation. And after the issuance of a certificate of authority by the Secretary of State, the corporation shall possess within this state the same rights and privileges that a domestic corporation would possess and shall be subject to the laws of this state. So it's a different scenario where under the language that applies to consent that corporations have to give, irrevocable consent, to the laws that say the powers and the obligations of the corporations are subject to the laws of Minnesota are quite different than LLCs, which retain their being subject to the laws of the state where they are formed. So that is an issue that really wasn't fleshed out at the courts below. It's another reason why it's improper to bring these issues up.
It's a legal argument for why we shouldn't extend Rykoff
correct.
To LLCs.
It is, and again, Rykoff was decided at a time where, and based on law, where the mere presence in the state was sufficient to confer general jurisdiction. Well, we know that's no longer true. If you look at Daimler and Tyrell, presence in a state for a corporation or a limited liability corporation, so a business, legal business entity, it's not enough to be present. You have to be essentially at home in order for general jurisdiction to be conferred. And again, that's what we're dealing with in this case.
And those cases dealt with corporations?
They did deal with corporations.
And you're arguing that those holdings apply to LLCs?
Correct. And I'm not aware of any, well, we do have the case from Delaware.
Is it
parts?
Is that in your brief?
That is.
Okay.
In our reply brief, and in genuine parts, the Delaware court came back and assessed what post Daimler what the law is with respect to how to read these same or very same statutes as far as appointing registered agents. Having provisions that say that if you don't have a registered agent, what the Secretary of State can do as far as acceptance of service. I see I am out of time. Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Jeff Markowitz, and I represent the railroad respondent, Soo Line. Soo Line respectfully asks this court to take one of two alternative approaches to this appeal, either affirm the district court, or if this court reverses, include the remand instruction requested in Section 6 of Soo Line's respondent's brief. Because Gavilan has not contested that request for a remand instruction, and neither has Reed, I'll be devoting my argument just to the affirmance arguments today, unless the court has any questions regarding remand.
With respect to your second point, why couldn't one party or the other simply file another motion in the district court? I mean, why does that need to be directed by the Court of Appeals?
Your Honor, certainly the parties could, or Soo Line certainly could simply make that motion anew.
I mean, in the absence of an appellate ruling on it, there's no bar, is there, in the district court to making a second motion in light of changed circumstances?
I suspect that the district court, like most district court judges, would feel like the general rule against reconsidering prior decisions would potentially loom large in this case. And absent a statement from this court saying that at least reconsideration would be appropriate, if not a direction to do so, then at least saying the district court has discretion to reconsider. I suspect the district court would be extremely reluctant to do so in light of the general rules against, or presuming against, reconsideration. As to affirmance, this case comes to the court beneath two layers of binding precedent, one from the U.S. Supreme Court and one from the Minnesota Supreme Court. At the U.S. Supreme Court, we have the Nirbo decision, we have Schallenberger, and at the Minnesota Supreme Court, we have Rykoff-Sexton, which followed the Eighth Circuit in Knowlton. And those are two layers of precedent that Soo Line respectfully submits governs what this court should do today.
I'm sorry, Mr. Markowitz, before you get into the substance of your responsive argument, I feel like we need to talk about the lack of preservation.
Certainly, Your Honor.
And whether the argument may even be considered on appeal.
Certainly, Your Honor. And we would rest on our briefing as a general matter as to why this is a undisputed issue of fact, as to the fact that matters. It's an issue of law. And I would also direct the court's attention to a decision that's cited in our briefing that was not cited for this proposition, and that's the Rodriguez decision on pages 18 and 19 of respondent's brief. Soo Line recited it for one proposition, but on deeper diving into the decision, it really is on point in many respects to this case, including it was a decision in which the district court denied a motion to dismiss based on personal jurisdiction.
Federal district court?
State district court in New Mexico. And this is recent. It was decided in 2018, published in 2019. A copy of the decision is not there, but the citation is on those pages. The district court's rationale for denying the motion to dismiss was that it found specific personal jurisdiction. Consent by designation was not raised. On appeal, nonetheless, the New Mexico Court of Appeals concluded that it could address the issue in the first instant and didn't even reach specific jurisdiction because consent by designation was sufficient. The court acknowledged, and the court pointed to the fact that really there was only one fact at issue, and it was undisputed and essentially found by the district court that there was a registered agent in New Mexico from the Ford Motor Company, and that was enough. Mr. Masterson, in his briefing.
So the case law, which provides occasional exceptions to the rule of preservation, I think talks about whether the new argument, I'm looking for it, looking for the...
Is this the plainly decisive of the matter language?
Right. Plainly decisive of the entire controversy on its merits.
And it seems like
you got two phrases there that you have to address.
And the response to that is we're on interlocutory review, and that's for a reason. Interlocutory review is appropriate when there's a denial of a motion to dismiss based on lack of personal jurisdiction because we have a collateral issue that is indeed final as to a collateral and final right. As to that interlocutory issue...
That's different from the entire controversy, right? I mean, the right that you just identified.
Yes, with a caveat. Yes, and the caveat is that entire controversy language generally comes from decisions in which we're not dealing with interlocutory review. That's a rare situation. They're dealing with merits review in the ordinary case. But this is not the ordinary appeal. This is an interlocutory appeal, as it was in the Rodriguez decision at New Mexico. And the only issue, the reason we are on appeal is because there is an issue that's so significant that the denial of the motion of Gavilan's motion to dismiss was final as to a collateral matter, and that being personal jurisdiction.
Could I just confirm? Okay, so you didn't raise it below.
Certainly.
Okay, so I don't think that's in dispute. But we're here on appeal, and another thing that we look at on appeal, if you want to raise an issue for the first time, is whether it puts the other party at a disadvantage for having to address this issue for the first time on appeal. And in the briefing, they go through a whole series of things they would have done if it had been raised earlier, and that there's facts that it would have raised and would have dealt with if it had been raised in district court. Isn't that sufficient in and of itself to defeat the raising of this issue for the first time on appeal?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
The fact issues that were raised in the reply brief of Gavilan and the issues that were raised during oral argument a few moments ago are immaterial to the decision this court would have to make, which again would follow exactly what the Rodriguez court did in New Mexico. The only fact that matters is one that's undisputed, it's judicially noticeable, and it was at least partially found by the district court, that there is a registered agent from Gavilan in Minnesota. And that's the only fact that matters. As the Rodriguez court concluded, it would be unnecessary and somewhat of a, I believe the use of the language was a waste of time to do the remand, because there's no deference that would be afforded to a factual finding. There's no factual finding to make. There were two factual findings that Gavilan mentioned. One was it could have done discovery into the form, what was on the form for that Gavilan filled out. I understand Gavilan focuses on the irrevocable consent language, but I fail to see how anything about what the form actually said would matter here, nor has Gavilan made an offer of proof or representation of what would matter.
But if there's an absence of consent language in the statute, and if there were an absence of consent language in the application form, wouldn't that support an argument that that they have not, in fact, consented?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons, one at the federal level, one at the Minnesota level. At the federal level, the U.S. Supreme Court has been crystal clear, albeit in older cases that have not been revisited more recently. It's been crystal clear that this sort of format, this structure that Minnesota has, that says that by designating an agent, you consent to personal jurisdiction, is constitutional, is valid, is sound. That's Nirbo, that's Schallenberger. And so regardless of the nuances here about whether we're dealing with an LLC or a corporation, these are not bases on which to distinguish this federal case law, which authorizes the system. Coming to Minnesota and Rykoff-Sexton, the issue is settled. The only reason why Gavilan raises the irrevocable consent language problem is saying it lacked notice. It would have lacked notice of what the consequences of a behavior were. But again, if we look to, and this is the proposition for which Rodriguez is cited in our briefing, if you look to the fact that we have Rykov Sexton on the books for so long, that is notice of how Minnesota proceeds here.
Isn't Rykov, I mean, limited to Chapter 303? I mean, because Chapter 303 says on the face of the statute, I forget the words, express irrevocable consent, any person who applies under that chapter should know that because it's the law. But the LLC statute doesn't have that language, so they're not on notice. So the only way that they might know, or at least another way they might know, is if it's specified on the consent form, or if they must make a statement, excuse me, the application form, and if they must make a statement. That's the argument. But aren't they different because they're different statutes?
No, Your Honor. I believe I have three responses here. Let's see if I can reach them. The first is that, yes, we have these two separate chapters. We have Chapter 303, which is governing the corporations, and Chapter 322C, which governs LLCs, before that 322B. Both of them have analogous provisions, but for the absence of irrevocable consent. This was a riddle that I somewhat struggled with, because as we outline in footnote 6 of Sue Lyon's brief, there doesn't seem to be any functional difference between the consent that is being provided by the designation of an agent under the corporation statute and the consent that's being provided by the designation under the LLC statute. Even if you didn't have the word consent in the Minnesota statute, at the federal level, the U.S. Supreme Court has been crystal clear in Schallenberger and Nierbo. The designation itself, not the acceptance of service, but the designation, and that's Nierbo, Schallenberger.
And those were of corporations, I presume.
Those were corporations.
And do we know what the underlying, did the Supreme Court get into what the underlying statute said relative to whether a corporation irrevocably consents to service by registering an agent?
There's at least passive reference to this was done pursuant to statute, but there was no...
We don't know what those statutes
said.
And so you can't tell us that the statutes were missing the language or contained the language.
And that's precisely my point, Judge Smith, that this is a... That sort of detail was not material to the Supreme Court in those cases. When the U.S. Supreme Court dealt with those cases, it simply said, you provided your designation, that is consent. It's immaterial that this was as a condition of you doing business in a particular state, whether you were an insurance company or a corporation. And that's the same that's true here. I believe that the answer to the riddle is why would the legislature... So two points here. Why would the legislature not say irrevocable consent in one statute if it said in the other? Was it trying to communicate anything significant? I would submit no for two reasons. One, this is a model act. The 322C is based on a uniform model act for LLCs. And if you turn to the equivalent provision under the Uniform Act, which is 802A4 of the 2006 Revised Uniform Limited Liability Act, which is the model for this statutory scheme, it has exactly the same language that we have in our Minnesota statute without irrevocable consent. I would submit to you that the more likely explanation as to what's going on here is not that the legislature was trying to signal anything, but rather that it was just saying we're going to follow the Uniform Act. And I'd say exactly, it's exactly in all material respects. There's little tweaks, but it looks like the legislature was simply following exactly what the Uniform Act said.
And how do we know what the Uniform Act intended relative to consent to personal jurisdiction in a state of registration?
I would submit we can look to the federal case law from the U.S. Supreme Court, which says when you designate an agent, that is consent.
But I haven't read those Supreme Court cases, but it strikes me that whether or not they provide consent would be a matter of state law, and I'm guessing the U.S. Supreme Court what was the federal question before the U.S. Supreme Court? I'm just guessing that they were ruling on passing on the constitutionality of it, whether it satisfied due process
of a particular state statute. Yeah. And I would submit that if you look at those cases, you're going to find the Supreme Court operates at a very high level of generality. It's not getting into the weeds of what exactly each statute said. All it's saying that designation of an agent is consent to personal jurisdiction, and it's immaterial whether that designation was as a condition of doing business in a particular state. And there was no...
So it may indeed, the Supreme Court, following up, may indeed have accepted for purposes of its due process review that that there was consent, and the question is whether that comported with due process. But we're dealing... It didn't decide as a matter of state law that there was, in fact, consent.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I would submit to you I believe, Judge Smith, you referred to this as being a case in which the Rykoff section would need to be extended to LLCs, and I would suggest that simply isn't the case, in part because, again, we're operating at the federal level first, state level second. There have been...
Why is that a federal question, whether Rykoff applies to LLCs?
A federal question is whether this the program that Rykoff Sexton approved of, which, by the way, was before the LLC statute was enacted, before Chapter 5 was enacted in relevant respect in 1995. So the fact that Rykoff Sexton was just dealing with 303 is explained by two things. It was only dealing with a corporation, and the relevant statutes that exist today weren't in existence then, even though they follow in material respects. And the second is that at the federal, this is ultimately a question of federal due process, and what is the U.S. Supreme Court said is okay. When you rely on Daimler, on Goodyear, and on Tyrell, the argument at baseline is that the federal due process clause says that this type of action is not okay. It violates due process. And if this court were, if I could briefly conclude, if this court were to conclude the LLC statutes were, that designating an agent pursuant to the LLC statute was insufficient to satisfy due process, it would be ruling contrary to what the U.S. Supreme Court has told us about corporations, which are indistinguishable from LLCs in this context, and it would be ruling contrary to Rykoff Sexton and Nelton, which it followed, which approved of exactly the same sort of rules that we're advocating for today.
I have a question. In the reply brief, the argument is made that you agree, or that your client agrees that Gavilan is not essentially at home in Minnesota. Is that a true statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So you're really banking on Rykoff in order to justify jurisdiction.
And the federal case law above it, two separate levels of authority, which are independent. And if I may, Your Honor, the framing of the issue has been by Gavilan is that the simple designation of an agent is just one little old contact. That cannot be enough. That's exactly what the new case law from the U.S. Supreme Court has said. But this case is these issues, this analysis is about consent, not contacts. It's not, the significant fact is not that an agent of a corporation pursuant to Minnesota law is in Minnesota. The significant fact is that is consent. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said, regardless, without speaking to irrevocable consent language at all, has said plain and simple, when you designate an agent, that's consent to personal jurisdiction.
And so that, and therefore, minimal contacts are irrelevant?
Exactly, which was what Rykoff Sexton said in this context as well.
Okay.
It's a separate analysis.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
So I would like to address the last issue just briefly. I think if you look at the cases of Schollenberger and Nirbo, one thing you'll find is that those cases actually factually involved specific jurisdiction. This was not an issue like we have here where there's no connection between the state of Minnesota and the lawsuit other than the fact that the Siouxland can be sued here.
So they didn't deal with consent by virtue of having a registered agent?
So at that time, the law was that if the person was present, if you were served in state, you were subject to general jurisdiction. And so having a registered agent in a state automatically, by virtue of the fact that your agent is present in that state, you're subject to jurisdiction in that state. That was before International Shoe, Worldwide, Volkswagen, Burger King, all the cases that started to look at this. And we know that when it comes to due process, that fair warning is a major aspect of due process.
Well, the allegation or the argument is being made that because there was specific consent here, that that general jurisdiction can be asserted, and that all the concerns that were raised about minimal contacts and whether they feel at home, are they, you know, they're essentially in their activities in the state are such that they feel that the state is a home, are irrelevant. How do you respond to that argument?
So in Robert Mitchell Furniture Company, and that's a case from 1921, so even back then when the presumption was merely having an agent in the state subjected those corporations to jurisdiction, the court said that foreign corporations can consent, and all these cases say that the corporations may. They don't say that by virtue of registering an agent, you have consented. They may by that process. So they may consent by appointing an in-state registered agent as required by state statute. However, if the suit is based on matters transacted outside the state, personal jurisdiction exists only if, one, the statute expressly confers personal jurisdiction in those matters. We don't have that here. Or two, local courts have interpreted it that way. We don't have that either. And so what we have is a significantly different statutory means of developing a legal entity, a corporation, with terminology that specifically says consents, with language that says if you're a foreign corporation and you have a certificate in Minnesota, you are subject to the laws of Minnesota and you're treated the same as a domestic corporation. You don't have any of that with the foreign LLCs under 322C. So then the other part of that is after Robert Mitchell, again, you get into this fair warning under Burger King Corp. I don't believe that you can read Rykoff-Sexton and what it finds back in the day as far as what would apply to a corporation and say that that is fair warning to an LLC, that by virtue of the fact that they have an agent who can accept any process required or permitted by law and read that and say, oh, I know I'm going to now be sued in Minnesota for any accident that happens to any resident of a different state in Minnesota.
I guess I just want to understand, because you spent a lot of time in your brief talking about Daimler. But if there is, in fact, if we do consider the issue of whether there was consent because of the registration, if we consider that issue, are all the issues that were raised in Daimler irrelevant? I guess that's... If there's consent.
Yeah, so...
I want to simplify this because I want to know exactly what we're dealing with here.
So our motion was based on Daimler, and that's why we spent a lot of time on it, because that was the issue that was brought up on appeal. I think what we know... So Counsel for Sue Lyon has said that state and federal court also all say that if you have a registered agent, you have consented. Those states where Daimler and Tyrell were decided, and we've cited the case law and treatises that say all states require registered agents. So we know that all of those states required registered agents. That did not decide the issue.
But did they raise the issue of consent in any of those cases?
And again, it was not addressed by the court. But to the extent that counsel wants to say that all you need to do is have a registered agent and that's the end of the story, that's not true.
Okay, but as I understand it, the district court didn't deal with any of these issues, with regard to consent.
Correct. We do not have a Supreme Court decision that addresses the specific issues we're dealing with.
No, but the district court here didn't deal with it.
No, that's correct. That's correct.
Anything else? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And counsel, if you want to stay, you're certainly welcome to. I think that our high school group will maybe asking some questions, and we may be discussing how this all works. But you're certainly free to leave if you need to get back to the office, and I certainly understand that. But
are they going to be nice to us?
I don't.